Welcome to Between Two Rounds. Today I'm here with Caroline Peacock. Hi, Caroline. How are you doing?
Doing well. How are you?
Thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me on.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
My name is Caroline Peacock. I grew up here in LA in the South Bay. Went to UC Santa Barbara. I work at Techstars.
I hear UC Santa Barbara is a party school.
Yeah, every school is a party
school. Well, if you're in front of the ocean, it's a party school.
Yeah, I mean, you get a bunch of college-age students living right on the beach.
I would love that.
It was great.
Well,
it was the best experience.
And so you went from UC Santa Barbara to, what was your first role?
My first role out of school was at the U.S. Treasury Department, working in international affairs. So I was in the Europe and Eurasia office, covering 10 to 12 countries in Europe and Eurasia. So everything from Italy and Greece to the Baltics to Armenia and Azerbaijan. And did that for about 2 years. And then from there, wanted to come back to LA, be closer to my family. Moved to CAA, the talent agency. So did the ever popular Treasury Department to CAA pipeline.
Is that like a normal thing?
Literally, I don't think anyone else has done it.
They're one of one.
They couldn't be more different. But was at CAA then for about a year and a half, and now have been at Techstars for going on a year.
What are you investing at Techstars?
In Techstars, we are specifically investing in 48 companies per year through Techstars LA. We have run two Techstars LA programs that are more or less industry agnostic, but we over-index on deep tech, prop tech, health and wellness, e-com and retail, B2B SaaS, and climate tech.
Great.
And then we also run Techstars Healthcare, investing entirely in digital health in class 1 and 2 devices. And we also run Techstars Space, investing in everything space related. So everything from propulsion to quantum, to everything. Yeah,
we're really active in space, and we think that's the future. A lot of those industries that you with Kozlov invest in are really going to shape humanity, and that's what we hope to cover here today.
So
making 48 investments a year through Techstars must be a daunting task. How are you looking at these companies when making a decision? Because you must have thousands of applications.
Yeah. I mean, it's the lamest thing to say, but it's so much more art than science. So it's incredibly high volume, as you can imagine. And a lot of it comes down to, I mean, it's all early stage. So most are coming in having raised between 250K and maybe 3 million or so. And so what we end up doing is looking at majorly the founders. So we have to believe in the founders, founder market fit, the right team dynamics. And that's something that we really try to control for, because oftentimes when companies fail in the early stage, it's because of unfavorable team dynamics. And so
you'd be surprised how many founding teams will separate.
Oh,
whether it's through a venture fund, whether it's at a startup. My rule is, actually my experience is, when you build business on friendship, it tends to fail more often than when you build friendship on top of business.
Yeah.
And it was a mistake I've made in my past. And so I think, the art of the people skills, the people science, I guess you could call it, is really important.
Yeah, which I think, frankly, like, the humanistic aspect sort of underlies everything you do in life, but very much choosing these founders and choosing the teams that you're willing to bet on. So it's very much that. And then it's also, you know, looking at early traction, which in the pre-seed stage, there's only so much, but a lot of that is, do they have non-dilutive funding? So if they're a space company, do they have SBIRs or STTRs? If they're a healthcare company, do they have any funding from the NIH? Do they have pilots ongoing? What technical readiness level are they? So we're looking at sort of all of those things. And then the really cool thing is that we work very closely on space. We work with Space Force and NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab. And then on healthcare, we work super closely with two payers and two providers. And so we're always gauging their interests, because ultimately, at the earliest stages, they're selling into these entities as their customers. And so if no one is interested, it makes it a bit trickier to make that investment.
Yeah, but the decision-making within government isn't always the litmus test, the indicator of, like, does this make sense commercially?
Sure. I think it depends, though. I mean, I think on space, the commercial space industry is still so nascent, and it's certainly burgeoning and has expanded in, I think, exponential ways in the last 10 years, but still, you do sort of need government involvement.
Well, you do need government involvement. I guess what I'm saying is, I don't always look at non-dilutive financing as, oh, if they don't have it, it's a no-go. Because ultimately, if the government were to be the best investors financially into an industry, they would just run the venture funds. There's a reason that private markets run that.
Which they're increasingly involved in private markets, I would say.
Yes.
But I think even if it's not having non-dilutive funding, it's, you know, are they going to use this? Is this something that they're interested in? And so
100%.
We look a lot at that in the early
government
stages.
Is super necessary for emerging industries. And
yeah.
I definitely agree with you there.
Yeah.
You talked about the human aspect. Something I've come across, I'll have people reach out to me to talk to Type One on LinkedIn or a cold email, and they don't do much research or they don't connect with you on a personal level. They won't tailor their pitch to who you are or what you're looking for. It didn't even take a few minutes on your website to figure out what you've invested in or what may interest you. Talk to us about what makes you you, like what drives you and in the human aspect.
Yeah. What makes me me? I mean, I think really at my core, I just sort of want to be happy and, you know, I try not to sweat the small stuff. So you and I have obviously talked about this off camera, but I had stage 4 cancer when I was 8. I've had various health issues afterwards. So I've got sort of a whole list. I'm working with heart disease. I've had a spinal fusion. I'm missing half a lung. I've got, you know, can a whole litany. But through all of that, it's very much like it's hard to really be too upset about anything when you could have been dead 18 years ago and now you're not.
How old were you when you
I was 8 when I was diagnosed.
That must have been very difficult. It's definitely shaped your, I can tell it's shaped your outlook on life in a positive way.
It certainly has. Well, I think in situations like that, you can never control the bad things that happen. And bad things almost certainly will. You control how you react to it. And so you either turn an incredibly negative situation like that into something positive, or you sort of let it eat you alive. And then it's like, well, what's the point of being alive if you're going to be upset all the time?
It's a very stoic mindset. And I think it correlates to the startup world because startups are hard.
Yeah.
You know, innovation is hard. And you, when we're investing, we know that 80%, 90% of the time, it's not going to be a successful outcome.
Yep.
And if you're going into the race knowing that, hey, 90% of the time, I'm going to lose.
Yeah.
You have to have some grit and you have to have an outlook that allows you to overcome those obstacles.
Yeah.
And even if you don't, to get back on the horse.
Yeah. I think resiliency is really the key to everything in life.
I agree. And it's not a science on how you build resiliency.
No.
Because when you're up against challenges that make you soul search and dig deep, you really find out who you are.
But you also sort of have to be the type of person that can take the lessons from those sort of adverse events that happen to you. Because I think there are people out there that terrible things happen, and rather than taking it as like, okay, I need to look inwards and sort of recalibrate how I go about life, instead,
100%.
They sort of just let it defeat them. And so it is something where you ultimately are the one who decides. Like my favorite book of all time is East of Eden by John Steinbeck. And one of the lines in there is Tim Shell. And it's basically, thou mayest. And so it's like, thou mayest, if something bad happens, thou mayest take it and do something good with it. Thou mayest not. Thou mayest, you know, you can let it defeat you. It's all about you and you have that choice. And so ultimately, it's whether you make the choice or not.
Correct.
To take something positive from a really terrible experience.
100%. And I have a similar view on life where I live by a kind of like a quote that I saw when I was younger and always stuck with me. Mm-hmm. And I think it was by Theodore Roosevelt. And it was, do what you can with what you have where you are.
Mm-hmm.
Control what you can control. And don't worry and have anxiety over what you can't control.
Yeah.
When it comes to how that shaped your view on investing, those hardships that you went through and overcame, which, you know, hats off to you. It's incredible. Oh. It's an incredible story.
Medical technology is a great thing.
And so on that note, like, where do you think that's going? Like, what do you think the access to healthcare and like new innovative therapeutics and technologies is going to have on humans?
Yeah.
And how do you position that within when you look at things in investing?
I think the impact is huge and it already has been huge. Like pediatric cancer, using my specific experience, the eldest survivors of pediatric cancer in their 50s or 60s, because prior to that, it was just a death sentence. And so they've innovated in so many ways. And even when I was treated, it was still sort of at the point where you were just like, you know what, let's freaking nuke the cancer and we deal with the late effects after the fact, which I have a number of late effects, but whatever, I'm alive, so it was all worth it. But now they're really tailoring it to only give as much chemo, as much radiation as needed. Is absolutely necessary.
Or targeted.
Exactly. And even, I mean, when I was treated too, like the type of radiation that I got was much more targeted. So I've had tattoos on my chest since I was 8. And that was to target the exact plane of my chest where the radiation would hit. Whereas prior to that, it was like, again, just
And before, blast. What was it like? It was just everywhere.
Yeah, it was just everywhere. And so you end up dealing with so many different effects after the fact. And so even seeing that is incredibly cool. And I think there are innovations in so many ways, and health has changed in a lot of ways. I mean, we're dealing with all sorts of different things that we maybe didn't deal with 50 years ago. And so I think there's so much opportunity. The hardest thing is, I do think you have to have a risk appetite if mm-hmm. you're investing mm-hmm. in healthcare, mm-hmm. especially if you're doing devices and especially biotech, which mm-hmm. at TechStars, we don't really touch biotech.
We do a little bit.
Yeah. Biotech's amazing. I think it's some of the most interesting areas of investing. But again, you have to have that risk appetite because you could get to phase 2 trials and it could go kaput. And so you have to be willing to be like, you know what? We're putting it on the line and we're willing to accept that it may fail.
Of course.
And then I think too, there is a lot of regulatory red tape and getting through FDA trials and then ultimately getting health systems to adopt these new technologies. And I think
that's probably the hardest part.
It's incredibly difficult to sell into hospitals, but there are a lot of hospitals and some of the ones that we work with, like Cedars-Sinai, for example, they are so active in trying to adopt these new technologies.
Mm-hmm. They have teams probably dedicated.
They have teams. They have their own accelerator programs. They're really trying to help these early stage companies break in. And mm-hmm. so I do think there's a lot of movement on that front. And there has to be. Humanity can't stagnate and health can't stagnate. Like I said, we're dealing with all of these different
issues.
We're
not getting to Mars and being interplanetary if we don't.
We're not even successfully living on Earth if we don't innovate here.
Correct.
So, I mean, Mars way down the line, but even like having a good day-to-day where people have basic health, I think is something that, you know, these hospitals and these big payers, they do want and they're trying to innovate towards, but sort of like working with government. You're dealing with major bureaucracies.
Correct.
And so
And there's no one decision maker. No. It's consensus driven. It's
exactly.
boards and
exactly.
paperwork.
And every hospital and every payer functions differently. And so I think, you know, I am incredibly impressed by our early stage founders that are able to navigate that and navigate it with grace and ultimately with success. And we do everything we can to help that.
So speaking about planets, I know that as a man, when you reach 40 or 50, they always do the 2-finger check for cancer. When
sure.
when can we innovate around that? Have they started innovating around that?
Oh, well, I'm as a not man, I don't know. But I will no, probably not. I will say though, that's sort of the crux of all healthcare is
it's like we're gonna
free.
Be living till 150, but they're still gonna do the 2 fingers.
Yeah, but it's free to shove 2 fingers up there.
It's not happening. I'll take the cancer. Anyway, so is healthcare, biotech something that you're super interested in, or do you have other sectors that you're maybe more interested in than that?
It's definitely an area that I'm interested in. It's super meaningful for me to get to turn my own experience and bring it full circle into mm-hmm. my profession. So I'm alive because of innovations in healthcare. Anything I can do in my very minute, tiny way to help spur those innovations and impact other people's lives, I want to do. And so mm-hmm. I really, really love investing in that area. I think what I've realized about myself now is I love the tangible things. So I love med devices. I love hardware. It makes sense. You can hold it. You can see it. It's not this sort of it's not something you have to imagine.
It's not esoteric.
It's not esoteric. Exactly. You can look at it and you're like, here, I can hold this device. It makes sense to me how this works.
And you can build a mental model because you have something to draw on.
Exactly. And so that's
it's
sort
like
of
my dad. He's like,
everything.
Oh, you sell shoes. I can see the shoe. I can feel the shoe. I like cash. Put it under my mattress.
It's the tangibles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that'll never go away.
No. And it'll no.
Speaking
it
like
never
a
will.
Like a true Arab man, old Arab man.
Yeah. Anyway. Listen, I'm all about the tangibles.
Yes.
But yeah, so I think I've realized that I really like investing in those areas. So I love hardware. I love deep tech. Space is incredibly interesting. Broader aerospace.
It's a lot of space for innovation there.
Tons of space for innovation there. And it's, I think it's an interesting recalibration that we're seeing of people sort of going back into hardware. And
well, that's how Silicon Valley was started.
Yeah.
Around what was, okay, let's take a step back. What is deep tech?
Deep tech, I think, is everything.
Because everyone has a different definition.
Yeah. I think it's the intersection of like physics, chemistry, and what's the third that I'm missing? You know it.
No, I don't. Okay, I'm asking you.
It's the intersection of, yeah, physics, chemistry, everything like built by the laws of nature, I think. And so a B2B SaaS company doing marketing software is never going to be deep tech.
Yeah.
Biotech.
So there's true innovation in the sector. There's like some scientific progress.
Yeah. I think it's all based in science.
Okay.
And the varying degrees of science and varying types of science.
So, you know, in college, did you know that you wanted to get into a STEM heavy area?
Absolutely not. I'm like queen of non-STEM. I majored in econ and English. English was my fun major. So I love reading.
English
was
the one I hated the most.
Oh, English was my like, this is the fun one where I just get to write.
In high school, in 11th grade, I skipped English class almost every single day. Because it was at 7 a.m.
That's a damn shame.
One time, my parents walked into the room thinking I was going to school. I laid under the bed and put a pillow and a mattress. And anyway.
That's incredibly in-depth to hide from English.
I hid from English under the bed.
See, I'm the opposite. My 11th grade English class was incredibly formative for me. So I'd always sort of skated through school and done the bare minimum, which I, you know, carried on through college as well. But my 11th grade English teacher, she was the first teacher to ever give me, I think, a C on a paper. And part of that, I got an A. It was great.
I would have been happy with a C.
Oh, a C was like earth shattering for me. I mean,
I got a D in Middle Eastern history. I'm Middle Eastern and I love history.
Well, at school, I will say school, it boxes you in a certain way.
So she gave you a C.
She gave me a C and she was the first teacher that I'd ever had that was like, you're better than this. I know you can do better than this. And you just put in incredibly minimal effort. And I was like, oh yeah, I mean, you're right. And she was the one that really inspired me to actually try. And when I was a junior, she was like, you know, I see you going to college, majoring in English, becoming a writer. Hmm. So I was like, great, I would love to do that. I also do sort of need to make money, and I'm not sure that I'm cut out for the starving artist type. I don't know if you can see, I like jewelry and I like clothes and things like that. And so I also then majored in econ. So I was like, I'll do English as the fun major and I'll do econ as the, you know.
I majored in econ because that was the only thing I could major in because I was good at it randomly and I had AP credit. And then I got to my junior year and I went to the counselor and I was like, what classes have I taken that I can, what can I major in? They're like international affairs and economics. I'm like, that's the one.
Perfect. I would love to do that. I was surprised by, like, if you went back to my senior year of high school econ teacher, he would be shocked that I went on to do econ. Because in high school, I was like, oh, whatever.
Yeah, not a lot of people like economics in high school.
But I ended up loving it, especially the international.
Well, are you more of a macro econ or micro?
I'm a macro girl through and through. Because the cool thing, I think, is econ underlies everything.
Yep.
It underlies politics. Well, finance
is a subcategory within economics.
Totally. Yeah. Econ rules everything. And if you can't reconcile the economics of things, you're never going to understand anything else.
And that's really important to investing.
Yeah,
a lot of founders overlook that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a big economic fundamentals gal. I think it's incredibly, incredibly important. And I credit Treasury with really instilling that in me. And I frankly just landed at Treasury in the coolest, most serendipitous way.
Soft landing, hard landing?
soft landing for me. Remains to be seen for the U.S. economy.
you're talking about what you studied and now you're in a very STEM heavy field and a very male or heavy industry with it when it comes to deep tech and startups.
Yeah.
How would we bring more women into the field from the educative level to get more involved in STEM? Like, how do you see that happening? Do you see that happening? And do you think that there's other things that could be done?
Yeah. I mean, I think it starts in school, like secondary schools. I think, and this is just sort of my broader take on like education generally. I think we need to do a better job of preparing high schoolers for what the various paths forward are, mm-hmm. whether that be going to a four-year university, going to trade school. And I think emphasizing it there is incredibly important because that goes on, like my English teacher, she went on to influence what I went on to go and study. And I think if you really make a concerted effort at that point and then get girls to go on and do STEM in college and compete in college in that way, I think that will change it, but it's hard to do in our education.
I also think that the media does not make it easy.
No.
You have, as a young man, you grow up and you see people like Elon Musk and mm-hmm. these men that are in these fields.
Yeah.
That you look up to being like that.
Yeah.
That's like the modern day rock star. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to create an example for young girls of
yeah.
why this is so important.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
So you could be one of them.
I don't know. I'm not really a woman in STEM. So I would leave it to somebody that.
But you are a woman in STEM because ultimately, and I'm a man in STEM. Like I'm not yeah. a scientist.
Yeah.
But we are backing the brightest minds in the world and helping
yeah.
them innovate. And we do our part in that.
It's true. It's true. But nonetheless, like I think I'm so grateful to be in this, but I would.
Not to take away from like the people that actually do it.
Yeah, when we lean so heavily on really technical experts, and I think giving them a voice, and even if that's like, you know, LA has Caltech and Caltech is incredible. It's getting female students and professors from Caltech to go into high schools in the area and give presentations,
exactly.
things like that.
That's
I think
important.
It has to start at that level. And then even more granular, I think a lot of it is like sort of your parenting, which can't control, but I credit so much of who I am and how I've navigated life and professions and being in male dominated fields with both my parents.
The Fed was probably super.
It was actually, you'd be surprised. It was
really?
A pretty good.
It's super cool.
I mean, when I interned there, I was in an office of all guys. When I worked full time there, it was maybe like half guys, half girls. And so it was actually pretty good. But yeah, I credit so much of it with both my parents, but really my dad for instilling in me, like, you can go and kick all of these guys' asses. Like, you
really?
Just because,
you fight?
Oh, yeah.
Are you a fighter?
No.
Physically,
I can't kick anyone's ass.
Okay.
Maybe like a 12-year-old, and even then, I think it'd be up for grabs.
There's 12-year-olds are a lot bigger than I thought.
Yeah.
They're like
growth hormones, baby. It's all in the dairy.
Is it? Can I have some milk?
But yeah, so I think that's a big part of it too, is like having. As a woman, having male figures in your life that are your biggest supporters
yeah.
and really boost you up
yep.
and don't really try to put you in any sort of like mm-hmm. historically female category
right.
is incredibly important. Whether that's a dad or an uncle or a brother or a friend, like whoever, or a mentor, really, like mentors are huge on that front as well. And so I also think that's important.
I also think there's a current trend, and maybe I'm wrong, but there's a current trend where women are being like, it's okay to do traditional
yeah,
fields that are
totally.
For women, or like you
totally.
Want to start a family, or if you're a man and you want to be a traditionally, like we are moving away from traditionally masculine things
mm-hmm.
and like making men be less masculine
yeah.
and making women be less feminine. And it's okay
yeah.
to choose both of those paths. We live in a free country
Completely.
To be able to. So I think it's really interesting the way those dynamics are shaping up.
Everything sort of overcorrects one way or another before
pendulum.
It comes back. Exactly. And so, no, I totally agree with you. I mean, if you want to be somebody that, like, you're a woman, you're like, honestly, all I've ever wanted is to be a mom and raise kids and do that, fabulous, do it. That's an incredibly important
part. There's
nothing
wrong with that.
No, nothing wrong. And frankly, how your kids are raised builds the foundation of
society.
Our country and society.
Yeah.
And so it's an
you
incredibly
break down the
important
nuclear
job.
Family and crime goes up.
Yeah.
All these problems in society start, and we're seeing
totally.
That.
And it's such an important part, and I don't think it should be negated in the least. And equally, if you're a woman, you're like, you know what? I don't want kids. I love my job. I want to do this. Great. Like you said, it's the beauty of living in a country where you get to choose exactly what you want to do. And I don't think you should be shamed either way. For now and hopefully forever. I have faith in how the country will go.
Get out and vote.
Yeah, truly. But yeah, so I think there are different paths for everyone, and people are meant to do different things and have different skill sets that make them better at different things. And so trying to force anyone into any box is just sort of a fruitless exercise, because people will find their way and find what sort of calls to them in the end.
When it comes to what you want to do long term, because you've had interesting experiences to shape your view on life.
Yeah.
What do you think draws, like, calls to you? Do you think you're going to be investing for the next 10, 20, 30 years?
This is what I ask myself all the time. I've always had what I view as an incredibly good problem, but I think I could be happy doing so many different things. And I think ultimately it's because I just am sort of a happy person.
I want to be a gardener or a potter.
See, I don't have the green. I take good care of my plants, but I don't have the outdoorsy green.
See, I take a venture approach to my plants.
Okay.
I buy a lot of them.
Spray and pray.
And then a lot of them die.
Okay.
But the ones that live, they live.
See, I take it in the same approach to plants as investing, that I'm very intentional about the plants I bring in. And I take very good care of them and nurture them.
I nurture my plants. I talk to them in the morning. You know, if you talk to your plants in the morning,
they love it.
They actually, it's scientifically proven that they grow better.
Yeah.
If you say good things as opposed to if you say negative, hateful things.
They're still live beings.
They did a study where they took water and froze it under a microscope. And I don't know if maybe we can try to pull it up, but I don't know if this is, you know, peer reviewed or what have you. I just saw it online where you speak to water that's about to freeze and you say positive, loving words.
Yeah.
When it freezes in beautiful crystal form.
Interesting.
And if you say hateful things to it, it freezes in like very ugly way shapes.
Not so, to get too woo-woo, but it is sort of the energy of things.
The power of thoughts. The power of thoughts. Thoughts lead to action. Action leads to habit. Habit leads to a life.
Yeah, it's true.
But so you don't really, do you have, if you were to choose today, what would be your long term? Would you stay investing? Would you start a company?
I think I would stay investing. And that's sort of my game plan. Very much like master of none, jack of all trades. And what I love about investing is that you get exposure to so many different things. And every company is different because the people behind the company are different. Even if they're solving in the same vertical, they're going to have radically different problems. And I love that because you're always learning, you're always challenged, you're always stimulated.
Intellectually stimulating.
Exactly. Whereas I think if I were in any one profession where the day-to-day was super similar, you're dealing with the same issues, I think I would get bored.
Mm.
So yeah, I mean, sitting here right now, investing is what I want to do. Will that change? Probably. People change, priorities change.
Of course.
I still think maybe there's a future for me at some point as a writer, but I'd always sort of tried to reconcile the two sides of me, of like the econ and the English side. And I love the analytical side of things.
I'll buy your book when it comes out.
Okay. Can't guarantee it'll be good, but I'll let you know.
Well, it's okay. I have a big bookcase at my house. I'm addicted to buying books, but I don't read them all.
Okay.
I have a feeling that if I buy a book and it sits on my bookshelf, I will take the knowledge through osmosis. I really am convinced of that.
I like that idea.
Can we look that up?
Yeah, that must work.
Book osmosis.
I think it's if you put your hand on it, you absorb even more.
Well, that's why they pledge allegiance to the thing.
Yep.
Okay, interesting. And when it comes to space, where do you see space going? What are the trends you're currently seeing? And what do you think is going
to
happen?
I'm excited to see where space goes. I think it's so incredible, the growth in the industry in the last 10 years. And a lot of that is SpaceX doing it. And they've really just opened up the commercial space industry in a way that
leading the charge. Yeah.
Yeah. Completely leading the charge and just unprecedented. And so I'm excited to see where a lot of these early stage companies end up. I do think there's still a lot of growth and the late stage doesn't yet match, but it'll have
there's
to.
There's not a lot of investors that are playing in the A, B. We're trying to do more A, B investing because I think that's where when companies are ready to scale, they've hit all their milestones. There's still not a lot of people that understand how to underwrite those risks.
Exits are still lacking in space in a lot of ways. I mean, I think you have the Rocket Lab.
I think historically, we do not have the data to show what exits will look like.
Exactly.
Because the historically, the industry has never been where it is. Mm-hmm. It's essentially a brand new commercial space industry. The companies that went public in 2016, 17, 18, 19, those companies were started in 2008 or before, 2010.
Yeah.
And they had way different macroeconomic factors to deal with. SpaceX didn't have cheap launch up and running by then. And so I think we're going to see an explosion of exits, positive exits in the coming years. But those are the companies that were started under the umbrella of lower launch costs, better access to space, which means if you have better access to space and cheaper access, the underlying components that you build in your satellite or whatever it is you're building can be cheaper, can be off the shelf.
Yeah.
So it's super interesting to see it all play out. I think the big risk is a lot of startups are buying from startups and they all need funding.
Yeah. They come in with LOIs from other startups and I think, look, in sort of any hype cycle, you have the companies that will go on and sort of die out, and you have the companies that will go on and prosper. And that's sort of just the nature of the beast. And I think we're at an interesting point in space because a lot of these companies are coming up in what is a much more economically difficult environment to go on and raise in. And so I think that the fundamentals and the real like technical viability of these products is going to be way more important and already is. And so I think some of it's controlled where in, you know, 2021, 2022, when money was cheap and free flowing and there were a lot of funds and a lot of startups getting funded.
Can you call your friends at the Fed and bring that back?
Everybody would like that. Well, listen, I think interest rate cuts are happening later this year from what I understand. Not insider information, just based on...
You heard it here first.
No, you heard it anywhere else first. But so probably we'll get a little bit further back to that. But I think this is why I always sort of try to underpin the economics.
Look, I'm Lebanese. We love free money. That's why we have such high inflation.
Everyone
in
loves free money. I'm Argentinian. Same thing.
Well, Malay. He's bringing...
Malay, yeah. Malay is a controversial figure, but it sort of can't get worse for Argentina. So we're excited to see where it goes.
It's darkest before the dawn.
Let's hope so. It's been the darkest before the dawn for a while over in Argentina.
100 years. You know, Argentina was the fifth largest economy in the world like 100 years ago?
Yep. It's an incredible backslide.
It's insane. Yeah.
I think it's a good lesson to everybody that no one is immune.
It's a good lesson in the perils of socialism. Mm-hmm. And we are trending really close to that line in America. It's interesting.
It's an interesting time to look at. I think, you know, there's like Ray Dalio in Principles. He had a few chapters where he wrote about sort of the rise and fall of empire. So Dutch Empire, fall of Dutch Empire, British Empire, fall of British Empire, rise of American Empire. And everything that sort of—
Rome never fell.
Rome, no. Rome, I think about Rome it, is still
I
going.
I think about Rome every day.
Italy killing it.
No, I go to the bathroom. I'm thinking about the Roman Empire.
Yeah. Can't build Rome in a day.
You can't destroy Rome in a day.
It's true.
It's still there.
It's true.
It's called the Vatican.
So I think he had something really interesting where he was like sort of detailing all of the factors that led to the fall. And so the consistencies are incredibly low interest rate environments, incredibly high public debt, decreasing levels of education. And when you look at the U.S. sort of follows all of that. Mm. And it's scary, but I don't know that I agree with the conclusion he comes to, which is the U.S. will probably fall and China will likely take over. The interesting thing is that globally, we're in an economic environment of incredibly low interest rates, incredibly high public debt. And so the U.S. does have that going for it, and that it is still, it is, I mean, I think public debt needs to be addressed. Interest rates probably were far too low for far too long, but it's sort of in line with where everything else is economically across the globe. And so it's hard to know sort of what will happen with
it. Do you think that we can grow ourselves out of debt?
No.
Why?
I just think that we're at a point right now where the government also needs low interest rates because our interest rate payments are so incredibly high.
I think it's 70% of every taxpayer dollar goes to interest debt. Yeah. Right? Can we check that?
it's an incredible, incredible stat. And I think you would have to have such explosive growth to grow ourselves out of
it. Okay. Well, explosive growth, define that.
Explosive growth, I mean, it would have to, I can't give you a specific percentage, but GDP would have to grow so significantly to actually get us out of that debt. And I don't necessarily think that that's doable. And I think the bigger thing is to have that level of growth, it means you also have higher levels of inflation. And inflation is always a tax on the consumer, and specifically the consumers on the lowest end of the socioeconomic totem pole. And I think that's incredibly damaging, and incredibly damaging to not only buying power, but consumer sentiments, and also then just sentiments as citizens of the country.
So do you think, so on that note, hype or real AI? And do you think if we had AGI in the, you know, the near term, would that provide the explosive growth that maybe
I think AI
makes the historical trends that Ray Dalio is talking about fall apart, because we've never had that sort of technological information revolution to.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the answer there is. I think AI is a mix of hype and real. Like, again, like any hype cycle, I think you'll have the companies that actually do quite well, and then the companies that fall away.
That's natural.
That's natural. It's what always happens. But I don't know. I don't know that AI will be enough to give us that growth, but maybe it will. I think you look at a lot of these sort of one-time innovations, and they do have the capacity to create so many different opportunities that we can't even imagine. Mm-hmm. I think that's what's sort of beautiful about capitalism and creative destruction is when one industry dies, new opportunities arise through that.
Yeah, it's like the Luddites in England who thought that because there was a mill, they would lose their jobs, but in reality, they would just be repurposed.
Exactly.
They would build new skill sets and they become more efficient.
The really important thing though there is having upskilling initiatives.
Correct.
To help those people that are sort of let go or cut from these innovations
But we also have freer access to information.
Absolutely.
And so 100 years ago, you had to be wealthy to go to university. Mm-hmm. Now you can go on Google or on YouTube and like learn anything.
Totally.
You know, I learned all the history I know from YouTube, not from my Middle Eastern history classes I mentioned before.
John Green on YouTube.
Huh?
I don't know if you ever watched his videos.
I have his books.
Okay. He's like a big YA author, but he also does great history videos.
Okay.
So
I watch battles and generals, and I like weirdly watch like how the battles happened and how the people moved. It was really cool.
Yeah,
it's interesting. I don't think historically we've ever been at a place, and this is what everyone has said, it's like famous last words, but historically we've never been at a place where the geopolitical turmoil is as crazy. Information access, you don't know what is true or what is not.
Yeah.
You don't know who's lying to you or who's not. But then on the other side, we have like amazing innovation. Like people can build businesses with one person with AI and with all the
two sides of the same coin.
It's insane.
I think on the geopolitical front, it's interesting because with the exception of some countries, I really do think that developed nations like the US, like China, what is our new warfare is not going to be what it used to be. So World War II, you're not going to have mass destruction necessarily in terms of boots on the ground, people fighting each other on the front lines. It's going to be wars of information and cyber.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of a whole new realm that it's always been an undercurrent to the extent that the technology allowed
it. But now it's at the forefront.
And now it's at the forefront. And I think we're going to have to adapt to that in some way.
You know the Roman Empire, back to the Roman Empire.
Obsessed.
I'm obsessed. Like every 90% of men, I think, because there's a meme, right? The Roman Empire was successful because they had the best military technology.
Yep.
And that allowed them to expand.
Yeah.
And so what do you think of like the military industrial complex? Do you think it's necessary or do you think we've gone too far?
I am so torn on this because I think at my core, I'm very anti-war. And I just think ultimately, like, I don't know if you've ever read All Quiet on the Western Front.
No, but I'll buy it.
Okay. It's amazing. It's about World War I, written from the perspective
Osmosis.
Of a German soldier, Osmosis. It's an incredible lesson in that, like, the people who actually fight the wars are not the people that are waging wars.
Yes.
And you have people who ultimately don't really care that are being forced to die on the front lines because of larger powers at play.
Yeah.
And those powers will never see war ever, really, except from the luxury of their own office. And
yeah, like, have Zelensky and Putin actually go to the front line, the war would end.
Exactly. Exactly. And so I think it's an interesting lesson in that, like, I am so vehemently against war, but I also think that to maintain the ideals that I so deeply believe in,
mm-hmm.
and that the U.S. I think is, you know, sort of the beacon of.
What's the word when you, when it's, I forget the word, when it's like, because you're strong, nobody screws with you.
Exactly.
What's that word?
I don't know.
I've
only had a half a coffee today.
There's a whole coffee in your cup.
Yeah, but I'm fearful because my friend says I gulp loudly, so.
Let's test it.
I can't do that.
Come on, let's gulp. Now we have to test it.
Now it's
closer,
going to be
close
even
to the
worse.
Microphone.
Okay, I'm gonna. This
Caroline
is,
Peacock.
What is this?
Gulping.
What, don't people pay money for these videos? Yeah, ASMR. You're welcome, everyone.
I'm not going to say it.
I tried to do a semi-loud gulp. So keep me posted on how that turns out.
Who's louder? Answer in the comments.
Yours was way louder, I think.
I that way you don't feel so bad.
Thank you. Thank you. It's one of my deep insecurities.
What other insecurities do you have?
Ooh, good question. I don't think I have that many, to be honest. Deepest insecurities. I don't know. Probably never finding love. I don't know that that's an insecurity, but it's maybe a fear.
Mm.
I don't think, we'll see how it pans out. Come back to me in like 10 years.
10 years?
10 years.
That's a long time to wait.
Yeah, I guess it is. Yeah, love waits for no one.
It does not. It does not.
Yeah, I don't know. Insecurities, I actually feel like I don't have that many. I think it all goes back to, like, again, once you've survived stage 4 cancer, you're like,
what's the worst that can happen?
Yeah, I'm like, I'm going to care about stupid things.
When I shut down my startup before starting type 1, my whole self-identity was predicated on the fact that I had a girlfriend and I was dating this girl, mm-hmm. and I had a startup. And so that's who I am. I'm the CEO of this company and this is my girlfriend. And when those two things evaporated overnight, and then I didn't know who I was at that point because my self-identity was morphed by something externally.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really important for founders and for just people in general to really understand who they are and not have an externality, because everything can be taken away from you.
Yeah.
So I think that's a super interesting way to look at the world. And
I think you've got really is yourself. And I just think it's such a waste of being alive if you're spending all your time worrying about things that are out of your control. Like, and I do think it takes sort of recalibrating yourself and going and stopping and smelling the roses, going and sitting outside and being like, wow, it's such a beautiful day and I love having the sun on me. Stupid things like that, that are ultimately sort of the most important things in life. So when I used to write 3 good things that happened to me every day, and
that's
on
really, cool.
really shitty days, it would be like, oh God, what good happened today?
I thought about the Roman Empire.
Yeah, it's something like that. You're
That's
like,
I always look forward to
I had
to
a
it.
Great coffee and it was awesome and it woke me up. We're like, oh, I ate something that I really liked. I sat outside for 10 minutes. And so I think when you're forcing yourself to see the good, it ultimately ends up meaning that you never have to force yourself to see
positive
the good.
Thoughts lead to positive actions, lead to positive life, habits in life.
Yep.
All right, rapid fire. What's your favorite movie?
Ooh. Oh my gosh. I don't know. This is really hard. There's a Polish film called Cold War that I really love.
Why are we talking about war so much?
I don't know. It's sort of the theme of this, I guess.
Well, I guess we do a space.
Great film. And then also like the stupid ones. I mean, favorite versus most quoted. Most quoted, Shrek, Borat.
All right. Give me a Borat quote and Borat accent.
Very nice.
How much?
The easiest one.
How much?
I like a very much a quirky buchek. Bing, bang, bing, bang, bing.
That's very good. Another
thank
one.
You.
Come on, let's get another one.
The other one I can't do. But
this is my neighbor. What was his name?
Azamat. One day you break out and you get this.
I get the clock radio. No, he goes. I get a clock radio. He cannot afford. Very nice.
That one is so good. One time when I was at Treasury, when my coworkers couldn't get his badge to come in, And I was like, you would never get this. You would never get this. La, 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 la. And he was like, I can't believe you just said this to me. And
I literally watched Borat and The Dictator every day in college for like 3 months with my friend Michael. And we got so good at quoting it. He's actually really good at quoting it.
Oh, they're so iconic.
It's great. They don't make movies like that anymore.
No, they don't. I did quote Forrest Gump when I came out of my
Life's Like a Box fusion. Of Chocolates.
No, super obscure one. And I have no idea what it was in reference to. But I said, in my best attempt at a Forrest voice, which is not very good, I said, that's good. One less thing. And I quoted it. I was like in a drugged out stupor. And my dad and my brother in the room, and I guess they were like, did
you just quote Forrest Gump?
And they both know it well enough to recognize the obscure quotes. So, right.
Well,
yeah.
We got to run Forrest Run soon because we're ending
okay.
time.
All right.
I guess the last question for me would be, what would you like to see in the venture industry over the next 5 years? What company that doesn't exist yet that you would like to find?
Rather than company, what I would like to see is I would like to see VCs have enough conviction to lead rounds without needing a lead. Like, I think it's a fairly common thing now that VCs will be like, yeah, I really want to invest.
Who else is investing?
Once you find a lead, yeah, who else is in the round? And I hate that because I think investing should be about having very deep conviction. And if you don't have enough conviction to lead, then you probably shouldn't be investing. And so that's one thing that I really would like to see. And obviously, you know, capital requirements are a different thing. If you don't have the funding to lead, fine. But if you do, lead the freaking round. Like, balls on the table, just do it.
Whoa, and that's a weird picture.
Yeah, well, it's true. And so that's, I think, what I would like to see most.
Cool. I even think, like, when it comes to, we've led rounds where we've put together SPVs for those rounds. Mm-hmm. And I think that more people doing that and innovating around the venture model. The venture model doesn't have to stay to just 2 and 20 and a fund and that's it.
Totally.
I think we'll see innovations around the venture model because that is required and that's needed.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
It was a great, can we get one more Borat quote?
My wife.
That's it?
That's all I got.
Okay. That's underwhelming.
What's up with it, Vanilla Face?
Oh, that's a good one. What's up with it, Vanilla Face?
What's up with it, Vanilla Face?
Where do you put the pussy magnet? Does this car come with pussy magnet? I want a... Can you give me one?
Pamela!
Pamela! All right. Thank you for being here. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.